Welcome to the BMJ podcast. I'm Cameron Abassi, Editor-in-Chief of the BMJ. This week, I've been at the Nuffield Summit, which is a meeting of think tanks and NHS leaders where the future of the healthcare system is discussed. The BMJ hosts a roundtable there, and we were asking, how will tech, and particularly AI, affect the doctor-patient relationship in the near and far future?
We assume patients are the sort of laggards, the kind of non-adopters, the kind of problem in the digital and tech space. Well, who are patients? It's the general population. It's us.
At the BMJ, we've also announced a new data and code sharing policy. I'll tell you a little about that later. And we'll hear from Ben Goldacre, who's been pushing us towards transparency for years.
Code is as central to quantitative research as the methods of your study. And we need to treat it seriously in those terms. We need to give it the respect and we need to give it the airtime. And so that's why this call from the BMJ is so valuable.
Finally, as the UK Labour Party has just said that the economy is in the worst place since the Second World War, a new play is looking back to that time and how the politician Aneurin Bevan was inspired to overcome economic hurdles and set up the NHS. Matt Morgan, BMJ columnist, has turned his hand to the stage as medical advisor on the play, and he reflects on what he learned.
There's a phrase, we all contain multitudes. And I think that's absolutely true of Aneurin Bevan. You know, he wasn't all good.
Firstly, though, the future of the doctor-patient relationship.
Hi, I'm Juliette Bouverie. I'm Chief Executive of the Stroke Association, which is a UK charity that provides stroke support for stroke survivors and their families. And I also chair the Richmond Group of Charities, which is a coalition of 12 national health and care charities advocating for more policy attention on multimorbidity.
Hello, my name's Daniel Elkalis. I'm Chief Exec of the London Ambulance Service, which does what it says it is on the tip.
That's good to hear. Thank God for that.
Hi, Rebecca Rosen. I'm a GP in South East London and Senior Clinical Fellow at the Nuffield Trust.
Hi, Neil Sabir. I'm Professor of Pathology. I'm also the Chief Research Information Officer at Great Ormond Street Hospital.
Great. So first I want to go to you, Rebecca. AI, is it, and technology? I mean, often, you know, politicians love technology as a solution to all our problems in healthcare. What's the reality of it?
It's really still under development. And at the moment, if you look at the rise and fall of Babylon, the digital first GP company that claimed to have AI that was going to radically transform the way this worked, what's happened is that it's actually its decision algorithms didn't really have much AI. It was just a set of algorithms. And that's because in the nuanced, complicated world of general practice with undifferentiated illness and a mix of physical and psychological and social, AI isn't there yet. We've heard about it being really effective where it's got focused applications, interpreting images. The world of general practice is far more complicated and varied. And so there's a lot further to go there. But I think there are other areas of general practice where it's really going to change things, and that's in the administrative side. Filing notes, helping with recording conversations that will be turned into well-structured entries in the medical record. And that, in theory, could transform the way we work hugely. So the Oxford Institute for Technology has argued that around 50% of general practice admin will be able to be automated in the coming years. So there's a lot of work that we've got to do, but it kind of feels like it's on the near horizon.
OK, thank you. Juliet, can I turn to you now? What, from the patient perspective, how do you see the value of AI as a tool?
Yeah, so, I mean, I suppose my starting point is, well, healthcare is basically a relational business. And, you know, what is so important is that sort of individual relationship, the trust between patient and clinician, the sort of shared power, shared decision-making, and clinicians really taking the time to understand what matters to individuals and really listening to their needs. And I just wanted to talk about two examples of kind of the adoption of AI. I really agree with you, Rebecca. I think AI, where it's targeted on a very specific clinical problem, is already producing tangible benefits. So if you take stroke, it's kind of extraordinary, the adoption of AI in stroke imaging. So now, since the pandemic, really, because of the necessity of the pandemic, we've got 96% of stroke units in England. that are routinely using AI in stroke imaging to augment and support clinicians to improve both the speed of diagnosis, the specificity and the accuracy of diagnosis, and then access onto the right treatments. And what's extraordinary is one of the early adopters of AI in stroke imaging, which is the Royal Berkshire Hospital, where I was there a couple of weeks ago, they've now published data, and I just want to get this absolutely right. So they've now published data that shows that the adoption of AI in stroke imaging has led to a 60% reduction in the time to mechanical thrombectomy, which is a very time-sensitive treatment. And that equates to a 300% increase in patients achieving functional independence. I mean, it's kind of extraordinary data. So, I mean, there are real benefits that are being realised today.
Julia mentioned some impressive evidence there, some data, really. But evaluating AI and research associated with AI methodologies is difficult. It's not straightforward.
Yeah, exactly. And there are the technical aspects about how you evaluate a particular tool, but actually that's almost only the very first step. Hmm. So saying that you developed a machine learning algorithm that does something is of no relevance whatsoever if it doesn't do that task that you thought it would do or doesn't perform in the way you had thought in a real world setting. So at the moment we're in this time where there is relatively lots of peer-reviewed papers saying I've written the cool thing.
A very large number all of a sudden, yeah.
But relatively few papers saying this cool thing that I wrote about before, we've now tried to apply it in all these settings and here's how it performs.
So let's turn to Daniel. Daniel, you mentioned that there were real-world examples at the London Ambulance Service. How is it being applied?
So we're into how can you use all this technology and AI for volume. So in any day in London, 15,000 people will call us on the nines and the ones. So, for example, if you phone 999 and you're in a category one, so you're really, really sick, the computer is now dispatching the ambulance to you within 45 seconds of the phone connecting because the computer is listening for the keywords that you're saying as a patient and can it can translate that much quicker than the call handler can.
How do we know it's getting it right?
Because the volume of Cat 1s has remained broadly the same, the patient mix is broadly the same, and you've got a call handler who's just monitoring that has the computer done the right thing when they've caught up with what the patients have said. Mm. So that's probably our best example. I think the big game changer is actually going to be with clinicians doing their clinical assessments over the phone. So whilst the call handling is currently very structured, the clinical assessment is very unstructured, but that means clinicians are spending a long time after the call to rewrite all of their notes to make it make sense. And the latest version of lots of this software would just record what the person has said, put it in verbatim, and then structure it into a record. So all the clinician has to do is check that what the software has done is right. So I think that will save a huge amount of time and will be good. The place where I think we're going to really struggle, which Rebecca's already talked about, is triage. So if you look at the dispositions of people who use 111 online compared to the people who phone to use 111, the 111 online is much more risk averse than a conversation between people, even when the person is using the structured triage tool, because the digital algorithm has to be totally risk averse. And then the other thing that we've been discovering is that, so we've started answering the phone for a GP practice, and the patients know what they need, but aren't always as good at describing what they need. So you end up with their description being something which is much more serious than they actually meant it to be. And so I think in the end, my big learning is the AI is only going to be as good as the person who is using it is at being able to describe what it is that they want.
Hmm. I mean, Julia, does it concern you as, you know, speaking for patients, that your call is being handled by an AI algorithm, a large language model?
I mean, I think I'd probably say a couple of things. One is we assume patients are the sort of laggards, the kind of non-adopters, the kind of problem in the digital and tech space. Well, who are patients? It's the general population. It's us. The vast majority of people have got mobile phones, very comfortable with FaceTime, WhatsApp, text, you know, sort of pretty digitally literate. Mm. So that's the majority, yeah? And I think we underestimate actually how ready patients are to adopt digital and digital tools, digital self-management tools to help them manage their health and care. And then the only sort of downside is obviously there is that risk of digital exclusion. You know, we shouldn't assume that every patient is going to be able to cope with tech and with an older population increasingly struggling with complex, multiple long-term conditions, including cognitive challenges. We do need to be tailored and targeted in our approaches, don't we? But that's where big data, big population data, and intelligent analysis of that data, so you're targeting your resource, can really help.
If the public are, I mean, that's a generalisation. Some people clearly, you know, find technology a little difficult. Others are adopting it very avidly. What does it mean for the profession, Neil?
So I think it's a super interesting area. There's a lot of stuff, there's a lot of taking on from what you mentioned, Julia, around what do we need to tell patients? You know, how, at what point, if you just use it for admin, do you need to tell patients? If you use it for clinical decision support, how much do we need to tell them? But if we just ignore all that for the moment around, I think there is a big benefit in looking to what are the immediate problems, but also this will come. These things are going to come in. So what about in 10 years or further? And it is impossible to imagine that we will not be having lots more clinical decision support through AI. I think there's also an interesting thing that we're talking here as if this is all being driven by the medical profession. I think a lot of this is going to be hugely driven by patients. And it's interesting, Julia, from your example, we will get to a point. I mean, lots of these tools, I would imagine, will become like we as a society think of sat nav now. You know, I will come and patients or families will say, okay, this stroke algorithm, I don't want a human looking at it. I'd rather have your algorithm because your algorithm is better. So the patients will actually start demanding tools once those tools become of a certain accuracy and quality. So it's not just going to be the medical profession that drives this. We're going to have to respond to patient pressure. Yeah. But the question then comes is, how should we be selecting and training our doctors? Because actually, at the moment, we select doctors to say, can you remember the top 10 causes of atrial fibrillation? Rather than necessarily, are you going to be able to work with these tools? What's the role of the doctor? Because the sort of other components will become relatively much more important, and certain tasks we do now will become relatively less important.
Okay,
so it changes the dynamic.
Yes, what does it mean? I won't accept your challenge about naming the top 10 causes of atrial fibrillation. But what will it mean? What will it mean for how will we train doctors? Let's take doctors. How will we train doctors in 10 years' time?
So I think the first thing is going to be to make people very aware that they are going to have to change the way they work and the tools that they work with. And that in itself will be less of a challenge than I think much of the profession thinks, because many of the medical students that are coming through now are already super keen. They want to work with technology. They understand the benefits of AI. But what we don't have really is a clear strategic plan in most organisations or across the NHS for what's the hierarchy of how we're going to do this? So in the next 3 years or 5 years, what are the areas that you as a new medical student are likely to be using AI with? Whereas if you're going to be, for example, a surgeon, probably you're not going to be replaced by a robot for many years to come. Whereas if you're going to be a radiologist, you know, if you're going to be a radiologist, certain parts of what you do are much more likely that you will have to work with an AI tool. And I think we just need to get clearer at being very explicit about that.
Okay. What's your view on this, Rebecca?
Well, I think listening to the comments we've had so far, there are some bits that fill me with great joy. I would love Daniel's technology that's going to automatically write my notes, as long as I know that it's going to do it well. But I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish. And I think there is this sense that it's going to come and just do bits of my job. And I think the feeling that I carry with me is I'm going to have to learn ways to work alongside technology. There are some bits that will just be taken away, but mostly this is going to be a challenge of how do you rethink the chain of interactions from when somebody turns up at the GP door to when they leave hopefully better or with a plan to manage a long-term problem in ways that blend the technical, the human, the empathic, the informative in different ways. And so in terms of the question of what I think I'm going to have to learn for the future, I think I'm going to have to learn new ways of communicating, new ways of taking information and interpreting it and helping the people who it's targeted at to understand and work with it. I'm assuming that I'm going to be working with decision support technologies, sitting side by side with a patient. But and I think I'm also going to have some really big challenges because I think one of the most impressive applications of this that I've seen is rethinking an MSK pathway, which is integrated across the community physio, general practice, hospital, completely deconstructing it, looking at every bit of it. Hang on, we can get a bot to do that and take away the human activity. We can get a bot to do that. But here you've got to have human input. And that kind of development work and then reconstructing the pathway and putting it back together is a huge developmental challenge. And certainly in general practice, not many of us are good at it. So I'm going to want some national resource that is going to support practices or PCNs to do that kind of deconstruction and reconstruction.
One last comment from Daniel.
I was just going to say, so in the examples we've all just been talking about, the patient is in a good place to use the technology. Whereas in the part of the world I inhabit, in urgent and emergency care, patients are sick, they're in pain. I think it is much, much more likely that the interaction the patient wants is with a person than with technology to start with. I can't...
Really important point. People's state of health and state of mental clarity really shapes whether they can use this. And we find that in general practice. Some of our patients on a good day are absolutely fine with our online consultation. On a bad day, couldn't possibly turn on the computer.
Tech and the future of medicine is a hot topic in our opinion section. And Rebecca Rosen, who you heard there, has written an opinion article for us. You can find the link to that in the podcast notes. The BMJ has announced some new rules on data and code sharing if you want to publish your research with us. And what that means is that if you have a clinical trial, you need to deposit your data in an appropriate repository, which is publicly available. And also, we are asking for you to share your analytical code for your study. And the code sharing applies to all studies. One exception to this is observational studies, which where the data may reside in large data sets and the permissions for those may not allow them to be immediately deposited in a publicly shareable place. And so we will develop rules for those in future. Now, the reason we're insisting on this is that there has been a voluntary code of practice operating for a number of years, and we've implemented this as well, where we've said to authors that on reasonable request that they should share and they will share their data. Now, authors at the BMJ and in many journals tend to agree to do this when they submit their paper, when we publish their paper. But what the evidence tells us is that when they do receive those reasonable requests, unfortunately, they do not share the data. So we've taken the next step and made data sharing for clinical trials mandatory. And the second thing that we've done is made code sharing mandatory as well. One person who's been very persistent and asking for this for years, I think the first time he did so was back in 2015 in the BMJ. And we're very grateful to him. It's Ben Goldacre. He's really nudged us in this direction. And Duncan Jarvis, our producer and multimedia editor, caught up with Ben and his colleague Nick DeVito to hear their thoughts on our new policy.
Hey, my name's Ben Goldacre. I'm Prof of Evidence-Based Medicine in Oxford, and I run the Bennett Institute for Applied Data Science.
And I'm Nick DeVito. I am a postdoc in Ben's group at the Institute. I also did my doctorate there, and I've been working with Ben since 2017 on all sorts of stuff around research integrity and transparency.
So, Ben, I think you're somewhat synonymous with transparency around research. You set up All Trials a decade ago. You've written books around it. What are your reflections on where we've come to now?
Well, look, on sharing summary results for clinical trials, we've seen that there's a gradual improvement across the whole community, and there's undoubtedly a gradual improvement in the culture. When we first launched the All Trials campaign with Fee Godley from the BMJ at the time, it was in an atmosphere of hostility, really. So I think both culture and performance on the reporting of clinical trial summary results has greatly improved. However, on sharing raw data, and in particular on sharing code, the computer programs that are used to analyse data, progress has been substantially poorer. Now, sharing raw data is hard because that raw data, which has detailed information about each individual person, is often the kind of thing that you can't share because of privacy reasons. Now, that raw data about individual people is often data that you can't share because of legitimate requirements around protecting the privacy of patients. If you've got a detailed data set, even if you've taken the names and addresses off, it's often very easy to identify one individual. So you need that data to be shared in a secure environment, which is why it's fantastic to see the BMJ editorial specifically saying, for example, for your clinical trial results, you should share it through a data sharing and data analysis platform like Vivli, which is the US clinical trial data sharing platform. When it comes to sharing code, progress is absolutely painfully slow. And I think that's partly because in a lot of cases, the wider community, especially amongst senior doctors, don't even really understand what code is and what its role is in the delivery of a research analysis or output.
And I will say the best sort of measure we have of that, like, you know, Ben isn't just making that up. It was actually published in the BMJ last year. There was a big systematic review and meta-analysis looking at code sharing and data sharing rates in health and medicine. And it was by Dan Hamilton in Australia. And it's just, it's awful. It's bad. Like single percentage point, like of examined studies share their code and things like that. And it's not much better for data.
Sharing your code is critical because by giving a complete account of exactly what was done with the data, you bring many, many, many good things. First of all, and probably at the forefront of most people's minds, when your code is open for everyone to see, it's open for quality checks, so people can see if there were shortcomings. Secondly, you also want code to be open for efficient reuse. So, you know, people have talked about science as being, is it Newton's line? If I've seen so far, it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants. Actually, the reality is, if you've seen so far, it's because you've stood on a giant pyramid of Lilliputians, right? There are millions and millions of tiny contributions which all add up to us incrementally progressing our understanding of a given field. Somebody else develops a reagent that you use in your laboratory analysis, and the next time somebody needs to solve that problem that is solved by that reagent, they don't have to invent the reagent, they just reuse the reagent that's been made by somebody else. And the same is true for code. When you have code shared for common tasks, then it's often quicker for a new user to look at it, evaluate it. If they think it's sound, reuse it. If they want to modify it, then they fork it, and so on.
So this announcement from the BMJ is moving this from a kind of carrot to more of a stick. You know, we're not going to publish unless you make this available. And maybe, Nick, if I come to you, what's your reading of the necessity of actually making that incredibly explicit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all a matter of perspective, whether it's the carrot or the stick, right? Because it's like no one is entitled to be published in the BMJ. I think I know that more than almost anyone. The BMJ's rejected loads of my papers. the carrot is still being published in the BMJ, right? This is just a thing you need to do to do that. There's someone needs to take a stand eventually, and only by being a first mover in this space are you going to inspire others to do it. And I mean, Cameron talked about in his editorial that, you know, there are some other requirements around code availability statements elsewhere, but to just make things so frank and so simple to say, you're doing original research that involves analyzing data, you have to share the code. There's just like an elegance and like really effectiveness to that that I think can't be understated. And people are not, I don't think, going to want to stop publishing in the BMJ overnight. And I also think that, I think, you know, some people are going to object to this and then they just won't submit to the BMJ. But I would hypothesize that that's a relatively small proportion of people. And I would think that there might be people to whom it never occurred to them to share their code, or they had just never got around to learning how to do it effectively, or loads and loads of other reasons. They said they would get around to it and never did. And now you're simply forcing them to do so. Let's hope it gets the ball moving on some of the other big journals in the field to start taking this quite a bit more seriously.
Mm. I mean, could you summarize this by saying it's sort of, I don't know, it's like the professionalization of coding and data usage within trials, moving from a gentleman coder kind of way of working?
Yeah, I mean, remember, it's not just trials, it's particularly observational epidemiology where I think this is critical. But I think raising the status of statistical programming, of research software engineering, is absolutely critical and spectacularly overlooked. You know, of course, it's great if journals are asking all authors to share adequately documented code as supplementary material. But also, institutions should be ensuring that researchers can access tools and training to support them in best practice around writing code, understanding basic principles like code review and version control. And that really barely happens except as a kind of hobbyist activity. You know, journals are one of the great whip crackers for the academic community. The other great whip cracker is the funder. Now, funders, as we saw with clinical trial summary results reporting, they have hundreds of pages, sometimes certainly dozens, of things that they tell their researchers, and people just sign a contract going, yeah, yeah, I'm going to do all of that. And then they don't really hold you to account for it. Added to that big pile, but also taken seriously, should be funders should require all grant recipients to share code in the same way that many of them already require that people share their data and results. And they should audit compliance, and they should review applicants' previous code sharing when they're assessing new applications, because it is by sharing code that you contribute to the community.
And I mean, if people are, right, this is like a research recognition problem in a lot of ways, right? Like, a lot of people don't share code at the moment because there's no incentive for doing so, right? Like, you don't get promoted for sharing your code. You don't get generally citations for sharing your code. And people are trying to change that and trying to do things like that. But like, the things that the academy generally cares about are not rewarded by sharing code. And maybe hopefully we can start to see some changes along that front as well.
Our data sharing policy is set out in an editorial I've co-authored with Theo Bloom, who's our executive editor, Elizabeth Loder, head of research, and Helen McDonald, our content integrity editor. And you can see how wide-reaching the impacts of this policy are by the range of authors involved. And you'll find links to the editorial in the podcast notes. Now, we're moving from 2024 to 1948. A new play at the National Theatre featuring Michael Sheen tells the story of an RM Bevan's journey in setting up the NHS. Matt Morgan, a columnist at the BMJ, was the medical advisor on the series. Matt joins us to talk about the parallels between then and now.
I'm Matt Morgan. I've got three bits to my life. I work as an intensive care consultant in Cardiff. I'm a full-time NHS consultant. I also do some work for BMJ, writing columns and working on various educational bit outputs of the BMJ. And the third bit of my life is, I guess, public engagement. I've written two books. There's a third one in progress. And I've just finished helping a play called Nye, all about the life of an RM Bevan and the birth of the NHS.
Hmm. You started there talking a little bit about your clinical work, your intensive care work. That's a big job in and of itself, but you've decided to branch out into these other bits and pieces. What started you doing that?
Working through medicine, I think I kind of realised after doing decade of research in hardcore science that public engagement bit is so important. And I found that I could better tell the story of medicine through words to the public rather than through perhaps academic words in journals.
Mm. And most ultimately through an actor's voice. But before we get to that, you mentioned that you've done some books. You've got one in progress. Tell us a little bit about what you've written about.
It started in 2019. I published a book called Critical. I kind of wanted to tell the story of intensive care medicine, a specialty I do. So the first chapter tells the story of the world's first intensive care patient, a little girl called Vivi, who at the age of 12 couldn't breathe because of polio. And that's really where intensive care as a specialty was born. And the book weaves human stories of patients with science and tries to tell the story of that specialty. But I am writing a third book at the minute, which is about people who have had cardiac arrests and survived, and what lessons on life can they tell about that. You know, there's lots of life advice books out there, but they've all been written by people who've only been alive, not who have been dead. And what better people to tell you what's important in life for people who have died and had a life 2.0, if you like. So, yeah, I hope that will strike a chord with people, and we'll see. Hopefully it'll be out in 2025.
And as we've said, most lately, you've gone from the beginning of intensive care to the beginning of the NHS, and you're telling the story of that. So what is NAI?
I guess the first thing to say is NAI is a play written by a friend of mine called Tim Price, who's an amazing playwright. And I've been the medical advisor on NAI. I've helped with the medical stories, the medical history, some of the props, some of the movements of the actors in that. And Tim and I actually went to university together. We were flatmates in the first year of university. 20 years after university, I had an email out of the blue from Tim asking if I can help with some of the medical bits. And it was wonderful. You know, it's something I never expected, a great leap of serendipity. And it's also a world, like writing was before I started writing books, it's a world I know nothing of. You know, I'm not somebody who goes to the theatre all the time. I'm a bit of a Philistine in terms of that culture. So stepping into this completely different world was pretty alien to me, actually. What happened was kind of magic. You know, I'm used to writing words on a computer, which become words on a piece of paper, and then people experience those words in their home or in their car, in their headphones or on the beach or wherever they're reading. But I don't get to see that effect on other people. It was a magical experience seeing words translated through dance and music and movement, and then people on your row and people in front of you and behind you responding to those in real time. You know, so I completely get that magic of theatre, really.
And you've got a great actor playing the main role here, Michael Sheen, who's obviously bringing his own stuff to it. But there's a lot to get into with that role, because Bevan was not a saint. He wasn't a kind of black and white character. Can you tell us a little bit about him and about what you found there?
Yeah, well, the first thing to say, I think Michael Sheen, who plays an amazing role, as do many of the other actors in the show, you know, he has an intimate knowledge of Bevan. He's looked through the history, he knows. So, you know, I'm picking these things up secondhand. I've learnt a lot about Nye and Bevan through Tim and Michael's interpretation. But it's absolutely true to say, you know, there's a phrase, we all contain multitudes. And I think that's absolutely true of an Iron Bevan. You know, he wasn't all good. The play goes through the complexity of his family setup and how perhaps he wasn't able to support his family in different ways because he spent so much time in these big institutional problems. And sometimes, you know, in medicine, there is a temptation to concentrate on those big policies and forget about the people. actually.
And talking of money and times, I mean, people will be looking at this thinking of any time in since the 40s when the NHS was made, this is probably the most opportune time to have a play like this to tell this kind of story.
The crazy thing is the play is set in two different time points, really. Prior to the NHS coming into existence in July 1948, it follows Bevan's life, and then towards the end of his life in the 60s. So trying to research the medical details for those two periods was tricky. But everything said, it could be today. And many of the issues brought up about hospital infrastructure, about health inequalities, about access, postcode lotteries, all those things, it could have been said in Parliament yesterday. History doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. And anyone going to see now, the problems are not problems from the 40s, 50s and 60s. The problems are human problems, living in a society as we do, which are as relevant today, if not more than they were then.
And you can find Matt's columns on our opinion pages. That's it for this week. We hope you've enjoyed listening. We always want to know what our readers and listeners are thinking, so do get in touch with us. You can leave a rapid response on any of the articles we've mentioned. We'll be back next time with the latest data on ultra-processed foods and health outcomes, and we'll also be asking what the future holds for NHS funding. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen, and we'll deliver a new episode to you every fortnight. Until then, I'm Cameron Abbasi. Thanks for listening.